Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Edgy Ideas is proudly sponsored by the Eco Leadership Institute. We offer coach and leadership training courses, and we have a vibrant community of practice where international members join once a month for a webinar. Our focus is on co-creating the good society. To find out more, go to www.ecoleadershipinstitute.org, and to read my polemic blogs and essays, go to Simon Western at Substack. Thank you for listening. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas podcast, and happy new year to everybody. Today I've got a special guest, Chloe Esposito. Chloe is a co-director of Lighthouse Relief, which provides emergency and psychosocial support to refugees and asylum seekers in Greece. Chloe's got a background in arts and journalism and human rights, and she uses this experience to drive strategy and to navigate the fast-changing humanitarian landscape. Previously, Chloe has written for the New York Times. She served as a United Nations correspondent, and her interest in refugees began when she was reporting on them in camps from North Macedonia. Chloe, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
Thank you, Simon. I'm happy to be here.
Good. So I met you, Chloe, just for the audience, I met you when I was running a training event in Poland for NGOs, and you came from Greece, and we talked, and I got very interested in your work. I've been watching the Greek refugees challenges for a long time with great concern, so I'm very glad to have you on and hear a bit more about it. What's your how long have you been with Lighthouse Relief?
About 2 years, but previously I've been working with some other organizations in Greece. So I have been working in this space in Greece for about 4 years.
Do you want to start just by saying why you got interested in this particular role and how you got involved with the Lighthouse Relief Foundation?
Absolutely. It was actually quite interesting because within the sort of the scene of small grassroots NGOs in Greece, you know, there's a lot of really great organizations, and there is generally, I would say, quite strong collaboration among them and a pretty decent sense of camaraderie. But then, of course, you always hear things about other organizations and shortcomings and mistakes and things that could have gone better. And Lighthouse Relief was actually the only one that I came across that when I was doing some research and some due diligence and asking everybody I know in their field what they think of the organization, that I heard unanimously positive feedback. Everybody emphasized the quality of the services that they provide to refugees and asylum seekers, but also the fact that it just seems to be an organization that really, really cares about people, and that comes through not only in the work that we do on the ground every day, but it really comes through in every aspect, in how we interact with other peer organizations and how we interact with funders and how we interact with our own teammates, with our own collaborators and volunteers. And so really that's sort of what sought my attention. And I was very lucky that when I saw that they had an opening, what they were looking for seemed to fit pretty well with my background, and it seemed like a natural fit.
Yeah, you've got a very interesting background. So you came into Lighthouse, and let's talk a bit about the kind of refugee crisis and what's happening in Greece and what's been going on there as well, a bit of background to kind of the work you do.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Greece has had refugees been coming and seeking asylum for decades, if not centuries. But really, the big turning point came in 2015, which was the year when because of escalating conflict in Syria, you had over a million people seeking asylum within Europe within one calendar year. From 2015 to 2016, it was 1.3 million overall. And out of that entire number, about 900,000 sought entry into Europe through Greece. And at the time, they were predominantly, almost exclusively, coming from Syria. Mm-hmm. And initially, there was quite a big outpouring of support and sympathy from the public at large within Greece. Partly this stems from the fact that there is also a history of being refugees within Greece during the population exchange between Greece and Turkey of 1922. Many hundreds of thousands of people who were considered Greek in Anatolia, Greek-speaking and Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, were expelled from what is now Turkey, and they came to Greece, and they lived through an experience that is not dissimilar to what refugees in Greece face today, even though they were considered Greek within the Ottoman Empire. By Greeks within Greece, they were considered strangers. They were considered the other, and they arrived under very difficult conditions. And many present Greeks, contemporary Greeks, grew up with stories that they heard firsthand from their own grandparents who were of that generation, who might have still been affected firsthand or heard it from their parents. So a lot of Greeks, when they were asked at the time, why do you think it's important to support refugees coming in, or do you think that we as a society should support refugees? Initially, there was quite a bit of openness and sympathy. That changed over the years. Today, the situation is very, very different. There are lots of reasons for that. One of them has to do, a big one, has to do with the big economic crisis that really sent Greece to its knees, that coincided with the refugee, the big flows of refugees starting. And it was just at a time where ordinary everyday citizens were facing unspeakable hardships in terms of losing jobs, losing homes, just the financial situation was really a mess. And so this had a big lot to do with it. But so did changing sentiments across Europe, especially within the last couple of years. We have seen a resurgence in far-right parties across Europe, including in Greece. Last year, we had elections in July, and we had the highest number of far-right parliamentarians elected in Greece's modern history, going back to the junta in the 60s. So it's, unfortunately, this impacts policies on the ground. This support has been reduced. The number of days that people have once their refugee or their asylum application has been approved and they receive refugee status, they used to have 6 months to find a job and housing before being cut off from state support. Now that has been shrunk down to 30 days. And this is just but one of many examples of why it's become much, much harder to access the asylum procedure. And then if you are accepted as a refugee, to start to rebuild your life in Greece.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for sharing that narrative of the story. I mean, what stands out for me is the initial part of the story you shared is how a personal and a collective identification with refugees or troubled other kind of opens up a space where you can actually do something important. And then the political kind of and the economic pressures which kind of shut down that space, we see across Europe, but specifically in Greece, where such large numbers are coming through. Do they are they still coming through? Is the main refugees still coming from Syria in the Middle East, or is it from Africa? What's the story at the moment? What's the present situation?
It's much more diversified now. After the Taliban came back to power in Afghanistan, we had an uptick of people coming from Afghanistan. Greece was actually also one of the countries where especially women who were in high-profile positions who were targeted specifically by the Taliban. Over 1,000 of these women and their families were evacuated through various international programs, and Greece was one of the transit countries for these families. So we had, at the time, for a few months, we had quite a few people coming from Afghanistan. We continued to have people coming from Syria and Afghanistan, but increasingly from other parts of the world as well, from various sub-Saharan African countries, from Cameroon, from Sudan. We also have had, long before the current war in Gaza, we have refugees from Palestine and Greece. We have really, it has become more of a global phenomenon after some of the devastating weather-related events, floods and earthquakes in Bangladesh and Pakistan over the last few years. All of these crises are driving factors that force people to flee, and many of them are still who are coming from either the African continent or anywhere east of Turkey. They're coming predominantly through Greece,
and that's because of just the proximity to the country, just regional positioning. Yeah,
exactly. It's geography, although it's becoming more difficult because the closest points between Greece and Turkey, some of the Greek islands that are geographically very close to Turkey, it's only a few kilometers. So initially, people were coming usually via the sea route in this very short distance. Now they are taking ever longer and more dangerous pathways because Greece has been unfortunately practicing pushbacks, which sounds quite benign, but in reality it can be extremely violent and sometimes even deadly. Basically, it's a way of intercepting people at sea before they reach their destination, and leaving them often stranded without an engine in a small unseaworthy boat drifting at sea or pushed back to Turkish territorial waters. It also happens in the land borders. We have the Greece and Turkey also share a land border in the region around the Evros River. And unfortunately, pushbacks also happen on land, but they are most known for happening at sea. So you have people who are trying to take more circuitous routes that they avoid areas where they know that they're likely to be intercepted. And this means going farther out to sea, deeper waters where they're more prone to storms and other mishaps that lead to shipwrecks and other devastating situations.
Sure. Let me ask you, most of our listeners, most of us read about refugees. It's kind of like a problem somewhere else. When Ukrainians fled and came into Europe, people like myself, we took Ukrainians into our homes, and then you feel it much more personally. You have a very personal kind of, you and your colleagues have a very personal kind of relationship to refugees and asylum seekers. How does that impact on you? How do you kind of manage that? What's your own kind of experience of managing the emotional experience of refugees and asylum seekers?
I mean, at the end of the day, refugees and asylum seekers are people just like anyone else, and they often have the same dreams, fears, hopes that I do and that my colleagues do and that most people share. So it's quite easy just to connect on a human level. And once you do, it becomes quite evident to those of us who are working to support them that, there's really no reason why they shouldn't be why they shouldn't have an opportunity to live and work and send their kids to school and have a normal life just like anybody else. It can be very emotional. As you said, we often interact with people who are in really, really desperate circumstances and living under, having survived many sorts of traumas, having survived unspeakable hardships, which caused them to leave home in the first place, but also experienced along the way. Unfortunately, it's not always safe, even within refugee camps, even if you do arrive to Greece and you avoid pushbacks and you avoid falling into becoming exploited by human traffickers or other nefarious actors out there, and you get to a refugee camp, it's not that you arrive and then all of a sudden you have everything you need and all your problems are solved. There are still risks, especially for women who are traveling alone. We have quite a large proportion of people coming to Greece are either single women or single mothers with young children, and they are particularly vulnerable along the journey and even once they arrive here. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Yeah, you did partly. I guess to follow on from my question is, how do you sustain yourself and your team? How do you sustain each other kind of doing this kind of work?
The key word there is each other and sort of being in it together. And we are one of several organizations that share a space in a community center, which is located in the center of Athens in a hub, in an area that houses a lot of refugees and asylum seekers, but also immigrants who have been in Greece now for multiple generations and who are living there. And fully integrated into society. And it is this sense of camaraderie, of kind of pulling each other up when we have a day that's particularly discouraging. We try to provide support not only within our own team, but also across all of our networks. And it can be as simple as just once in a while we have after work, get together on our rooftop in the summer, and we just kind of relax and mingle and mm-hmm. have a drink and just get to know each other as human beings and check in with each other as human beings, instead of always being in the chaos and the emergency, you know, rush of, yeah. Oh, we need your help now for this. And we don't really even have time to say good morning and ask how you are. So we do what we can. We also, there are some providers of psychosocial support for people who work in the humanitarian field, where they will offer pro bono coaching sessions or even therapy sessions to people who need support because they're sort of at risk of internalizing the trauma of all the people who we are interacting with on a daily basis.
Yeah. I mean, I'm working in the humanitarian sector at the moment, and the internalization of trauma is kind of interesting. What I'm observing is it happens in two ways. One, it happens on a personal way, so people can get post-traumatic stress disorders. They can kind of just suffer in many different ways. You know, it can impact on many different ways. Sometimes the individual is aware of it, sometimes not, and colleagues have to kind of support them. But it also happens in institutional ways. I'm interested in how trauma gets into inside institutions. I think less so in small institutions, but in the bigger ones, it manifests in kind of very odd ways, you get lots of dysfunctional kind of behaviors, yeah. Shadow behaviors being acted out, and often because of kind of people haven't worked through the process of the trauma and the emotional troubles that they've experienced. So it's very interesting to kind of be working in that space.
It's true. And when you speak a bit on the institutional side, it's almost sort of a double trauma, because you have the emotional impact or the emotional toll of the work itself. And then you have this constant existential threat, which is lack of funding, yeah. Which makes you always fear that, you know, you won't be able to keep your doors open for the next month. And then, of course, those two concerns, they feed into each other, because when you think about closing or the risk of closing, you're not just concerned about your own job and your teammates' jobs. You're concerned about the lack of services that entails for the people who really rely on them for day-to-day survival.
Yeah, absolutely. And and that's very different from the big NGOs. They have a very different kind of experience than the small NGOs I mean, we met in Poland, and a lot of people have traveled in from Ukraine. What was your experience of sharing stories and experiences with people from different environment, a war environment? What was your learning from that, or
It was
experience?
fantastic. I've actually stayed in touch with a few of them, and we're hoping to continue the conversations throughout the coming year. There is a lot of overlap, of course, in the type of work that we are doing on the ground, also in the fact that it happened in both context of Poland and Poland-Ukrainian border, and also within Greece. We had a context of it started almost out of nowhere and happened very, very quickly. And so it's a mad dash to mobilize support, but also expertise and know-how and sort of teach yourself very quickly what works, what doesn't work, how to become more effective. So I found that we had had a lot of similar experiences as small startup organizations. Of course, there's also one very big difference, which is that many of those small grassroots or startup NGOs that sprang up in response to the crisis very quickly formed funding partnerships with the big multinational actors, such as the UN and other big INGOs. Whereas the case in Greece was very different. So the sort of the model of operations and funding models are quite different, but the day-to-day work and the challenges that come with actually providing the type of support that's necessary, that's pretty much universal, I would say.
No, I was so impressed by these small NGOs who either pivoted from kind of maybe they'd be doing some multicultural work, and then they pivoted to kind of a million refugees coming in from Ukraine, and like within a week, within weeks, 7 days, they'd kind of established kind of a almost like a new organization, and the support they offered was quite phenomenal. And I think these organizations like yourself and can really teach kind of other organizations, even corporate organizations, kind of they talk a lot about agility and stuff. They can learn a lot from the small NGOs, I think. But then the struggle is, of course, is sustainability. One is not burning out, because you have such a you're on 24/7 when you're in a crisis. How do you sustain that? And how do you sustain the funding? How do you sustain yourself? How do you kind of get structures and management systems in when you've kind of got through the first year? All these questions we're working with people in Ukraine on at the moment. Am I right in recalling that you choose not to get funding from big donors? Is it a funding choice you've made?
No, I wouldn't put it like that. We get about 50% of our fundraising from relatively small grants through private philanthropic foundations around Europe, the US, Canada, mostly. And then the rest is from individual donors. It's not that we don't appreciate larger donations. We do have sort of an ethical criteria that we always abide by, that we would never accept money from somebody whose values don't align with ours. But otherwise, we're very, very happy to take your large donation if you know anybody who's offering. But it's really a matter of size. I mean, we started as a completely a volunteer run organization that we had effectively zero budget. And as we started to raise money, we put everything, for better or worse, everything into running the programs. And I say for better or worse, obviously the for better part is probably obvious to everybody listening now today. The for worse part is because there's always a choice, and the opportunity cost of putting all of your money to immediate programs to reach 10 extra families with a food basket this month, et cetera, is not investing in the organization itself, is not investing in the long-term sustainability of the organization by, hiring people who, on a living wage and providing trainings and professional development opportunities, investing in marketing tools and resources out there, everything from, paid versions of AI programs that can help automate things to You know, if you want to do a fundraising event, you know, it takes money to put on an event. It takes money to invest in donor relations and all of that. So Lighthouse Relief had always operated sort of programs first. Can help one extra person sleep somewhere safe tonight. That's the priority. But now we're in our eighth year of operations. And over the last couple of years, we have very slowly started to rebalance that a little bit. And I think it's something that all organizations need to grapple with at some point. When you get sort of reach your, let's say, teenage years, where the immediate kind of crisis phase has shifted and you're needing to professionalize and you're hoping to reduce turnover within the team so you can build up expertise and institutional knowledge and pass that along to future generations and not have to recreate the wheel all the time. And this is something that we came up quite a bit in our discussions with some of our peers in Poland. And so I know that it's something that is definitely not unique to Lighthouse Relief, but there's no answer. I don't think there is a right balance. It depends really on the organization, but it takes time to figure it out.
Yeah, it takes time and it takes a different skill set. It's quite interesting because the sort of adrenaline-led sort of initial startup kind of mentality is different to kind of the more stable, the strategic kind of mentality. It happens even outside the humanitarian sector. Like I work with a lot of small businesses and family businesses, and that kind of startup energy is people kind of get addicted to that energy. And they find it quite hard to transition when they get to from a small to a medium-sized company. A lot of them fall off at that stage, and it's kind of a different skill set. So I'm glad to hear you thinking about it. And in the show notes, just to let everyone know, we will be putting a link to the Lighthouse so that you can make donations if the audience would like to, because I know it's much needed.
Thank you.
What's on your mind at the moment in terms of your work? What's kind of front of your mind at the moment?
So we had some quite a few restrictions placed on NGOs that are supporting refugees and asylum seekers within Greece over the last few years. And as a result of some of these new restrictions, we have lost some of our access to some of the populations that we had been serving for a long time. So to give a concrete example, we had been running a mental health and psychosocial support inside the largest camp on Greece's mainland called Ritsona. And we had been working mostly with children, but we had safe spaces within the camp for separate spaces for women, children, and youth. And then through those spaces, we ran all sorts of activities, including sports, arts and crafts, informal education, classes, and various other things that were all led by people trained in trauma-informed care and were designed to help people cope with the trauma they have experienced, with the stress of living in limbo, in illegal limbo, while they're waiting on this decision on their asylum application and all of that. Unfortunately, about a year ago, we lost our access to the camp. And so we quickly pivoted. We were very determined to continue serving the people within the camp because we had been there for 7 years and we didn't want to abandon them. So we found a way to pivot, and we now take kids from the camp. We organize transportation for them that they can leave and play sports in local sports clubs in collaboration with partners. And so we have they 5 times a week basketball and football and various different activities for different age groups and some only for women, et cetera, et cetera. So that was, I'm explaining this as a way you asked about the challenges for the future. we operate within so much uncertainty, and we don't know, aside from the funding uncertainty, even the operational uncertainty. As you know, we got started on the island of Lesbos, where when I mentioned that 900,000 people entered Greece within one calendar year, of that 900,000, more than 500,000 came through one island, and that's the island of Lesbos. Yeah. We had to stop working there at the end of 2020 for a few reasons, but one of them was also because we lost access. So Greece, unfortunately, has been criminalizing acts of solidarity. So, for example, one of the things we used to do was search and rescue. We would stand lookout for vessels that were stranded off the shore, and then when we would spot them, we would mobilize support. And in the early days, before the big organizations had arrived, that meant calling the local fisherman and waking him up at 4 a.m. and then saying, "Hey, we need you," and going out and bringing to shore the people who were stranded and providing first aid, et cetera, et cetera. And we lost our access to the beach. We were no longer allowed near the areas where people were arriving. Then we're no longer allowed to operate inside the camp. So this is one of the challenges. How do we continue to support the people who need it most when it's getting harder and harder to reach them? Yeah, I'd say that's one of the main ones. And the other one is we've always tried to evolve based on changing needs. So, I mean, when this organization was founded, the people who founded it, they never imagined that 8 years later there would still be a need for humanitarian support within Greece, within the middle of the European Union. So there really wasn't a sort of long-term vision or strategy at the outset. What became sort of our driving our blueprint, if you will, was just to follow the needs. So as circumstances change, as policies change, and the type of support that people need changes, we want to be able to adapt quickly and sort of just follow what people tell us they want and need. Now the two by far most requested forms of support is for housing and then for food support. And housing is really the hardest to tackle because there are some government shelters, there are also some NGO-run accommodation sites, but the capacity is tiny in comparison to the need. And so we do the best that we can. We directly provide very short-term emergency support for people who are really in a life or death situation for a few days at a time. And then during that time, our social workers try to find them a more durable solution. But this is the number one thing that we hear the most: please help us find us somewhere to live.
Yeah, sure. And in Greece, the electorate voted in far right people, as you said. Is your experience that there's a kind of split in the country where there's still a generosity and an openness by a big part of the population, and then a fear and an anxiety and a negative?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's pretty much split down the line of whether you have personally met and interacted with someone from a refugee background or not. You have a lot of people who just the word refugee invokes fear, possibly an irrational one. And it motivates that person to take on an anti-refugee stance and repeat a lot of the anti-refugee rhetoric that is heard every day on the mainstream news, and sometimes even coming out of the mouths of certain elected officials and conspiracy theories and all of that. On the other hand, there was a study done at some point, and it showed that the biggest or the most effective way to change somebody's mind and stance toward refugees is to give them an opportunity to actually interact one-on-one and recognize the humanity in refugees and stop thinking about them as numbers and statistics and start associating them with the face of a particular individual and learning their story.
Yeah. No, I think that's Absolutely right, and it's I mean, and it's not just Greece, it goes across Europe, this kind of this split, I think, and then this kind of anxiety and fear, which is really exploited by a certain group of politicians and populists. And even in Ireland, we were very welcoming in Ireland, and now recently there have been two arson attacks on potential kind of hostels for immigrants to stop them from coming. It, and you can start feeling it bubbling away, that kind of fear, and politicians starting to exploit it. So it's a phenomenon right across Europe and the US, of course. So listen, Chloe, we're coming to an end of the podcast. It's been very, very interesting hearing your story, and thank you for sharing it. We'll definitely share your lighthouse links to fundraising, try and support you as much as we can. I
Thank
ask guests at the end of the podcast what it means to live a good life and to get a good society. Just any thoughts you had from your experience and your work.
Yeah, I think it's just the having the freedom to live safely without fear of persecution, and having the ability to find a home, to something, having affordable housing available, having job opportunities available that you can find something to do that gives you purpose as well as a paycheck, and being able to spend time with the people that you love. And I think it's how I would answer if you were asked me personally, but I think it's how most people would answer who are in Greece seeking asylum as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So thank you very much for sharing that. I mean, this word home is really important. I just think when you're a refugee and asylum seeker, it's not just about getting enough food. It's actually to find that stability, to have a home. It makes such a difference to your potential, your emotional
Yeah.
life, your relationships, everything, isn't it?
It absolutely does. I mean, it's one of the things that I think moved me to work in this field in the beginning. I'm fortunate enough to be born with two citizenships, a Greek and the US. And all my life I have just been able to move around the planet pretty much whenever I wanted without thinking twice. And if I need a visa, it's something I can usually get online within a few hours and $25, right? And there is no reason that I deserve that more than anybody else in the world. And it is about that. It's, as you said, it's not just about freedom of movement. It is about being able to be at home, to wherever you live. To feel that it's you belong and you can create a community.
That's right. Good. Well, thank you so much. Pass on our greetings and best wishes to your colleagues. Keep up the great work, and it's been lovely talking to you.
Thank you, Simon. Nice to talk to you as well.